Welcome to episode 306 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. I'm your host, Ian Martin. Today, we're going to be finding out about possibly Austria's most famous ski resort, Kitzbühel. We'll learn how to go cat skiing in Georgia and how Breedlabahn could be the way to ski in the Three Valleys without breaking the bank. Add in our regular snow reports, an Olympic catch-up with Shemi Alcott, and your feedback, and that is today's show. But before we meet today's guests, I'd like to thank Tirol Austria for sponsoring the Ski Podcast and making this winter's episodes possible. If this is your first time listening, I strongly recommend that you catch up with some of the great conversations we've had about Tirol this winter. Whether you want to know about Innsbruck or Ischgl, the Ski Veldt or Surfhaus, and plenty more in between, it's all in our back catalogue to catch up with. I've really enjoyed this series of episodes and finding out more about an area I actually thought I knew pretty well already. And if you keep listening today, you're going to hear about one of the most famous resorts in not just Tirol, but the world, Kitzbühel. Now, with that in mind, let's meet our guest today. My first guest joins us for her first time on the show, Anna Nurko from Kitzbühel Tourism. Hi, Anna. How are you?
Hi, Ian. I'm well. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much. I take it you are in Kitzbühel today, are you?
Yes, exactly. I'm in our office in Kitzbühel.
And how's it looking? How's the weather in Kitzbühel?
The weather is perfect today. When we look outside, we see the sun, we see the snow, and it looks like a perfect day to go skiing today.
Excellent. Well, I'll try not to take up too much of your time, and maybe you can get out there later. Let's meet our second guest. He will need no introduction to regular listeners. I've lost count of the number of times he has joined me on the show. He was last with us in episode 294 discussing skiing in Pralu. But he's also shared his insights on countries as diverse as Japan, Bosnia, Turkey, and North Macedonia. Welcome back to Mike the Snow Richards. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Good morning, Ian. Great to be back on the show. Yeah, fabulous. Thank you.
And are you in the UK just now?
I am. I'm back in Cardiff after a great week in Bachmaro, Georgia, which we'll talk about later.
Well, I am definitely looking forward to that. You actually sent me some of your photos and video on WhatsApp. And it looks fantastic. Looks so interesting. But we'll move on to that. Now, a question I do like to start off with at the top of the show is to ask my guests when they skied and snowboarded last. Mike has sort of given the game away a bit for him. But Anna, what about yourself? When were you last on snow?
Last week on Sunday.
Oh, and I take it that was in Kitzbühel, was it?
Exactly. It was in Kitzbühel. It was on the Kitzbüheler Horn. And the conditions, unfortunately, weren't the best. But still, whenever you get out there, it's amazing.
Do you mean it was one of those days where it was snowing heavily?
Exactly. For the last couple of weeks, we've had such a heavy snowfall and the conditions were really dangerous. So really needed to take care to stay on the piste.
Well, certainly we are familiar with that. We're aware that there have been a lot of fatalities across all of Europe. However, the positive side is that I think that snowpack is probably settling, and certainly the good weather that we're having now that you referred to that you can see out the window means that on piste you have absolutely amazing conditions at the moment. I will just turn to Mike. You did give the game away and say that you've been in Georgia, and we will be talking about that, and that was last week. Where did you ski just before that?
Before that, I was in Crans, Montana for the World Cup downhill, which was a really great experience. And as I've been traveling quite a bit this winter, I want to give a shout out to my regular ski partner, Chris Morris, who last weekend when I was away, he managed to go onto Hay Bluff, which is the border between England and Wales in the eastern part of the Brecon Beacons. And with his Zoa Engineering portable ski lift that we talked about previously, he managed to get 10 laps out of the one battery charge, which gave him almost 3 kilometers worth of uplift in a day on the mountains there, which looked fantastic.
And you've often told us, Mike, and shared on the podcast about skiing in Wales and the Brecon Beacons. But you're saying that Chris was skiing on the border between England and Wales. What kind of altitude is that?
It's on the Gospel Pass. So it's one of the highest roads in Wales. So when the snow does come in from the eastern side there or comes up from the south and hits that side, then it can be really well covered. Not a lot of rocks, really grassy slopes, even less rock than the main central Beacons Massif. So you're kind of looking between about, it's not very big vertical, hence why the uplift works on that portable tow. And so you get about 200 or 300 meter vertical laps. And from about 400 to sort of 700 meters in altitude range.
Amazing. Well, there's another ski resort or ski area that you can add to the list if you want to. That's great. Okay, well, there has been snow all over the Alps, as we mentioned, and we have some of our regular snow reporters have sent in their contributions. We have Alex Armon from Tip Top Ski Coaching in Leyders Alp, Alex Irwin from Courchevel, and James and Sinead from Sousy Online reporting from the Via Larta. So let's have a listen to those.
Hi, this is Alex from Tip Top Ski Coaching here in Leyders Alp. So we've got blue skies, sunshine and perfect snow conditions. What a fantastic week we've been treated to, with over 2 metres of snow in 11 days last week and the week before. We now have cloudless skies, warm temperatures and corduroy peace. The forecast for next week is to continue fine and sunny, but the temperatures to drop a little bit. See you on the hill.
Hi Ian, Alex from 150 Days of Winter with a Snowmageddon snow report from the Three Valleys. For over a week, more than 1.5 metres of fresh snow fell in the French Alps, probably the best snowfall in over 20 years. However, with all this snow also highlights the extreme avalanche danger that brought a 5 out of 5 warning for several days. Even when the mountain reopened, many off-piste areas were not recommended. The Châtelet chair in Monterey that services the snowboard park was damaged by an avalanche and will be out of action for the rest of the season. Several days later, there was a slide underneath the Padillac bubble at the top of Solier, covering a busy piste linking the Solier to Meribel. Despite additional bombings from a helicopter, several large slides were triggered to the left of the Chanrossa lift, off-piste, again highlighting the danger under their feet. On a brighter note, despite the current spring-like conditions, there is probably enough snow to easily last for the rest of the season. If you have the means, a sneaky post-half-term ski in the Alps would be well worth it. And if you're in Courchevel and you see a weirdo with pink hair and jacket, then stop and say hi. And on that, until your next snow report, ciao.
Hi Ian.
Hi Ian.
Sinead and James from Sousy Online here, reporting from the Via Lattea in Italy.
Yeah, it's a beautiful sunny day. We are in the grip of a high pressure, which I think is sitting over most of the Alps at the moment. We have had higher than average temperatures, which is in stark contrast to February half-term week, which was obviously last week, where we had some rather inclement weather. It was high winds and we had some snow at the beginning of the week as well, but this week it's in stark contrast. We are bathing in sunshine.
Feels like spring at the moment, which has obviously had an impact on the slopes. In the afternoon on the lower runs we are finding things a bit slushy and chopped up, but certainly on the runs higher up above 2000 meter there's still some fantastic skiing to be had.
Yeah, the snow depth is still fantastic up on the upper slopes. So, some great skiing to be had in the Via Lattea and also the neighbouring resort of Bardonecchia. I think that had a little bit more snow than we did over in Sousy in the last weather system that came through. But looking further afield, we are expecting a little bit more snow in the forecast for next week. But we're also expecting the temperatures to be dropping down to more like the seasonal average, so it should be a little bit cooler, but as I say, we are expecting a bit more snow coming in next week as well.
And we still have 6 weeks left of the season here. We lift close on the 12th of April, so there's still plenty of time to come out to Italy and enjoy what we have to offer here.
Yeah, that's it. So yeah. I think that's a wrap from the Via Lattea.
And just one note, when we had our chat with you a few weeks ago, we talked about the price of pizza and beer on the mountain. We've just had a fantastic lunch with full pizzas, drinks, great food, and it was €15 a head. Nobody with us could believe it.
Anyway, hope you're well, Ian, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Cheers, Ian. Bye.
Bye. Right, let's move on to Kitzbühel. Now, Anna, I know Kitzbühel is way more than this, but the first thing that most people will think of is the world famous Hannon Kalm race. So I think we have to start with that. I think this year was the 86th edition. Just remind us what kind of crowds you get for those races.
Well, basically, we can say that during the Hannon Kalm races, this week is the heartbeat of winter. We have so many people from different countries coming here to watch those spectacular races, and The town is crowded. There's such a great atmosphere, the spirit, of course, everyone who's watching the races is very interested, is enthusiastic. And I would say it's a once in a lifetime experience when you're here. And it's very difficult to describe it in words. It's just a feeling. And I would say it's a vibration. It's a great atmosphere.
And to put it in context, for example, for the downhill, how many spectators might there be watching that race gathered around the bottom and along the course?
So the Kitzbühler Ski Club has its own statistics, and they're saying that during the whole 3 days of the races, there have been somewhat about 80 or over 80,000 spectators.
So 80,000 across 3 days, I'm guessing more of them go for the downhill. So I'm going to take a leap and say, let's say maybe there's 50,000 or 40,000 plus for any one day. And when I was explaining this to my kids, I was trying to get them to understand it in context. And so picking a Premiership football match. Now, there are plenty of Premiership football clubs that don't get anywhere near 40,000 people coming to watch a game. But if you imagine a packed stadium watching a game of football and everybody there to watch the racing, it is an amazing atmosphere. But why do you think the Hahn und Kamm has that reputation? Why do you think it draws in the crowd so much?
I guess, first of all, because you need to be a very competitive skier to be able to ski in Kitzbühel. And this is what it makes it so outstanding, that only the best skiers get to compete here. And of course, the spectators come here and they get to watch the best skiers ski here. It's been taking place for the 86th year in 2025. So it's going to be the 87th time. It has such a long history. And of course, the Kitzbühler Ski Club, who's organizing this event, they have such a great infrastructure, logistic. I would say it's the combination of the heritage, it's the combination of this really competitive ski track, the Strive, to go down. And when you're one of the skiers who gets to compete here, it's outstanding. And the people who come here, they value this.
Yeah, I mean, you said it's a once in a lifetime sort of thing. I definitely want to include it in my lifetime. I want to get along and experience that atmosphere. I've been to a World Cup race before, and it was great fun, but it looked like it was nothing, you know, compared with that. And it's not just a downhill. I think people are probably familiar with the Strive you mentioned. They've seen skiers going at high speed. They know it's a really difficult course. But there's a slalom race every year as well. And I spoke to Luca Carrick-Smith, who's one of our up-and-coming young British skiers, who told me the atmosphere was insane on the slalom race as well.
Yes, I would say so. The atmosphere is very different compared from Saturday and Sunday. So on Saturday, you have the downhill, and on Sundays, you have the slalom. And the people who go and watch the slalom, they are really into the ski sport. They know the racers, they're interested in the history, they're interested in their times, they're really invested in it too. And so the atmosphere, I would say, becomes even more interested, even better.
I think that downhill and slalom are evidently, to me, the two most interesting racing disciplines. You know, during the Olympics, I watched both of those for men and women. I didn't watch the Super G or the GS. Less interesting to me. What I like about the format of the slalom is that second run where the skiers go in reverse order. So there's that real tension there that you get. And evidently, it's also the scene of British ski racing's greatest triumph, because Dave Riding won there in 2022. Were you in Kitzbühel around that time?
I was in Kitzbühel around that time, and I actually have seen him win.
I mean, for us, for Britain, you know, not a nation known for its skiing, although significantly improving, that was an extremely historic moment. And I understand there's a gondola in Kitzbühel that has his name on it, because the gondolas, I don't know which lift this is, you can tell us, has the names of all the people who won races there.
It's the Hahn und Kamm gondola. So basically every winner of the Hahn und Kamm World Cup race in Austria gets such a gondola named after them. And I believe in May 2022, after he Dave Riding has won, there was a ceremony where he was presented with a gondola where his name was on it. And now when you come and visit Kitzbühel, you might even be able to spot this gondola with his name on it.
Yeah, I can imagine British fans, you know, waiting at the bottom going, I'm not getting on that one. I'm not getting on that one. I'm gonna wait until Dave Riding comes along. And, you know, just out of interest, would you say that Dave Riding is more famous in Austria than he is in the UK?
Skiing in Austria is somewhat mainstream. So basically, a winner in Kitzbühel gets immediate attention. But I guess in the UK, when you win or when you're a winner, it just competes with a much wider sports spotlight. Either way, in Kitzbühel, his name is absolutely part of the ski story.
I think it's really interesting that if Dave, for example, was in Kitzbühel and was walking along the street, people would be stopping him for his autograph the whole time. Whereas if he walked around in the UK, most people wouldn't even recognize him. Well, Kitzbühel is evidently more than just the racing, but I understand that out of race time, the strife itself is remodeled. It's not the same format that it is for the racing. So you could never experience what the racers do if you were, you know, mad enough to try it. But you can visit the start hut at the top of the course. Is that right?
Exactly. So you don't even need to be able to ski. You can just take up the Hahnenkamm gondola to the top of the Hahnenkamm. And then within a couple of minutes of walking, you can visit the Starthaus. That's the starting point of the Hahnenkamm races. And you also have just a really great view over the whole racetrack.
And in that Starthaus then, does it have like the little wand? Can you sort of pretend to stand in the start gate as if you're about to do the Hahnenkamm?
You are able to do that. And the Starthaus is a photo point too. So you're able to stand there and have a photo taken. And this photo you can download with your gondola ticket afterwards on your phone too.
Cool. I love that. And so we mentioned the ski area and it's more than just the racing. You said you were out last Sunday. I wondered if you could tell us or we could talk a little bit more about the ski area. In my research, I have to admit, I haven't skied in Kitzbühel in the Kitz ski area, but it's a big ski area, right?
It is a big ski area. So the whole ski area has 233 kilometers of piste. It has in total 58 lifts. There are also 10 free practice lifts in the valley. So even if you're not a skier and you just want to try it out, you can use those free options. Also, the Bergbahn AG Kitzbühel is the company that runs all the gondolas in Kitzbühel. It has been named several times in a row, I think over 10 times in a row now, the world's best ski resort company. And it also operates on highly sustainable energy like photovoltaic.
Right. Okay. You've actually anticipated one of my other questions, because I did notice that Bergbahn Kitzbühel is a regular winner of the world's best ski resort company. You mentioned about renewables there. That's solar, but I'm thinking that that's probably not enough to run the lift system, but you use a lot of hydroelectric power in Kitzbühel.
Exactly. So the energy that's been used is mainly hydroelectric energy and backed up with photovoltaic too.
I've got another question about the environmental side of things, but actually before we move on to that, I also read about the Kitz Ski Welt Tour. I wondered if you could tell us what that is.
Yeah, the Kitz Ski Welt Tour is basically a ski tour that connects two ski areas, the Kitzski and Ski Welt Tour. And if you would ski this one ski tour in one go, you would have 88 kilometers, that are roughly 58 miles. And this whole ski route combines iconic lifts like the 3S Gondolabahn, and it also includes a short bus ride.
And is that accessible for all skiers? You don't need to be a really advanced skier for that. You just need to have a lot of energy and be prepared for a big day out.
Yes, I would say so. Of course, there will be parts where it will be a little bit more challenging. There are not only blue pistes on this route, so I would say you need to be confident on your skis. But on the other hand, there are different starting and end points, so you don't need to necessarily ski all the 88 kilometers. You can just start at one point and finish not by the end of the tour. But actually, my personal highlight would not be the Kitzski Welt Tour. It would be another recommendation. You can take a taxi from Kitzbühel. You can take this taxi to Jochberg, to Pastorn, and then you can head all the way back to the Hahnenkamm. And then you can either ski down the Hahnenkamm or you can just take down the gondola. And on this route, you have great huts, you have really great views and everything that you are looking for.
Mike, I had a sense from the fact that you were waving at me just then that maybe you've done the Kitzski Welt Tour yourself.
I wish I had. My first winter was working for Crystal as a chalet boy in the Ski Welt in Elmau. And at the end of the season, we had to drive around to Kitzbühel, which was a very, very different experience from skiing in the Ski Welt. So I would love to, knowing that there's link now, I'd love to go back and combine the two, because both areas offer tremendous skiing and a very, very different experience.
Anna, we mentioned the environmental side of things. I know most people will fly, when they go to Kitzbühel. And I think the nearest airports are Innsbruck and Salzburg, both close. But you can travel there by train as well, can't you?
You can. So Kitzbühel itself has three train stations, and it is very easily accessible through Innsbruck Airport, through Salzburg Airport, and through Munich Airport. From Innsbruck, you need over an hour only by train. From Salzburg, roughly 2 hours. And from Munich, it's again 1.5 hours. And it's really well connected to Kitzbühel.
Oh, and just as a note, you know, if there's anyone else out there like myself who prefers to travel by train just in general, you could get the Eurostar up to Amsterdam and then get an OBB night jet, which should take you down from Amsterdam to Innsbruck and get that connecting train as well. Now, during the Olympics, I got really into the cross country and I'm already a big fan of ski touring. I think Kitzbühel has great options for both of these, Anna.
Definitely. We have over 70 kilometers of cross-country trails, and we have, of course, also different ski touring options. And alongside that, we have guided winter hikes that we offer from Kitzbühel Tourismus too.
Right. Is that like snowshoeing or walking on paths through the forest?
It's both. We have guided snowshoe hikes up on the mountain, and we also have winter hikes where you still go up on the mountain, but you just don't need snowshoes because there are groomed trails for hikers to go up on the mountain and hike next to the piece.
Yeah, for sure. I find that people are much more interested in not necessarily skiing all day and experiencing a little bit more of resorts and perhaps getting away from the crowds a little bit. So that's really interesting. And in terms of accommodation, again, I have actually been to Kitzbühel, but I haven't skied there. My sense is that it's a bit bigger than some of the smaller resorts and regions that we've covered. And therefore, you've got a mix of all different types of properties. But there are also quite a lot of very good 4- and 5-star hotels there as well.
For sure. We have a real mix in Kitzbühel when it comes to the accommodation. You can find classic alpine luxury hotels up to sporty design-led stays. We also have farm stays in Kitzbühel. And what we would like to promote is that Kitzbühel blends elegance in town, but on the other hand, also the thrill on the mountain. And everyone can find something suitable for him or herself.
Now, I'm going to ask you a question I've asked most of my guests from the Tyrol to answer. And it might be a tricky one for you, but if you were on the mountain, you've been working hard on the slopes all day, you deserve a sweet treat. Do you have a favorite mountain restaurant that you'd be buying your Kaiserschmarrn at?
Well, so if you would actually take my advice and take up the taxi to Jochberg and then you would ski back to the Hahnenkamm, you would pass by the Bärenbad Alm. And I would recommend to stop there for an appetizer. Then when you continue skiing, you can have lunch at the Melkalm, which is a family-owned hut. And when you finish your ski day, you will pass the Rasmushof restaurant. And there you can enjoy a Kaiserschmarrn. But if you're looking for views, I could also recommend the Panorama Alm, the Sonnenrast. On the other hand, a little bit more cozy or tucked away, there's the Bichelalm. Actually, when you finish your ski day in town, you will also have a lot of options for Kaiserschmarrn.
Finishing your day in town, and also when you finish your day in town, like, here's another tricky one. Do you have a recommendation for après-ski?
I have several recommendations. When you come down the Hahnenkamm, at the bottom of the Hahnenkamm, there's the Legendencafé, a really great spot for après-ski when you finish your day. And then I also need to mention the Londoner. The Londoner in town of Kitzbühel in the heart has a really long history. It celebrates its 50-year anniversary this year. And also the winner of the Hahnenkamm races celebrate after the Hahnenkamm races in there. And it's always very crowded. You have a great atmosphere. And it's another once-in-a-lifetime experience when you're here.
The Londoner, is it a British-themed pub?
It is a British-themed pub. And if I remember it correctly, a British man founded it.
And when the winners of the Hahnenkamm go in there then, and they, you know, they celebrate in public, are they opening like a massive bottle of champagne? How does that work?
The winners are usually behind the bar, so they are serving the beers to the guests in a funny way.
Oh, I did not know that. That's really interesting. So thinking about the Hahnenkamm, for some downhill racers, actually winning that might even rank more highly than an Olympic medal. But we've just finished the Olympic Games. Anna, I noticed Austria won 5 golds and 18 medals in total. Did you enjoy the Games? Was there a sense that Austria had done well?
I mean, of course we enjoyed the Games. We were following them. And in general, we're just so proud of every Austrian athlete who has won and who was able to compete.
Well, I really appreciate that. I'm actually just going to move on to a little chat about the games now, but I really enjoyed finding out more about Kitzbühel. So thank you for that, Anna. Regular listeners to the podcast will know that Emily Sarsfield, Olympian and TNT sport commentator, and I have been hard at work over the last few weeks producing our special Winter Olympic episodes. We published our last one on Sunday, celebrating GB Snow Sport's most successful ever Winter Olympics, thanks to Zoe Atkins' bronze in the ski halfpipe. I think it's still worthwhile catching up with those episodes. They include a lot of interviews, including with our gold medal winners, Hugh Nightingale and Charlotte Banks. Also with Shemi Alcock, Graham Bell, Ed Lee, Eddie the Eagle, and plenty more. They're all short at about 10 to 20 minutes long, and so it's easy to binge your way through them. I do also have two more clips that I'd like to include today. BBC presenter Shemi Alcock sent us her thoughts on the games. And then after that, we'll listen to a quick conversation with three great prospects for future Winter Olympics. Zach, Luca, and Freddie Carrick-Smith share their thoughts on the future.
Hi Ian, I'm just driving home. What an incredible Olympics for Team GB. Some absolutely magical, momentous occasions. Hugh and Charlotte winning our first ever gold on snow in the team snowboard cross event was absolutely incredible. I think for me also, because of where I was, I'd spent so long in the Olympic studio watching all the sports unfold, and that was the day that I had to travel to Bormio. So I was watching it in the car because I wasn't driving. And then we managed to find a petrol station, a service station to pull over to. And so I got to watch it, not with Tim and Ed, because I had to watch it on Italian TV. But it was just, you know, I shouted the petrol station down. Actually, everyone else left and the television was above the loo. So I was getting some rather strange looks. But that was amazing. And then actually meeting Matt Weston after his double gold and Tabs, they came to the studio and he was so humble and excited. And I just love that he almost didn't realize how much of a life-changing moment for him this was. And then hearing that 3,500 people got in touch with British Skeleton after his golds, I just think that is the legacy of the games, people actually picking up the sport. The one thing we really wanted was that people didn't just watch the sport unfold on TV and think this was happening in a faraway place. We actually tried to bring it into their living rooms, tried to bring it into something that they could participate in. And we've already seen the implications of that. I think Zoe getting the bronze at the end there was absolutely amazing. The competition in the halfpipe was huge. She went stratospheric. But at the end of the day, it's more than just the moments where we see the podiums, where we see the medals. It's about the legacy that the Olympics leaves behind. And I think more than ever before, we have seen athletes go out there and dare to dream. We've seen athletes put their heart and soul on the line for something that happens once every 4 years with all of the exposure and the eyes of the world watching. And they dared to risk. And sometimes those risks paid off and sometimes they really, really didn't. I mean, there's such a thin line in winter sports between ultimate success and complete disaster. And we saw that with Lindsey Vonn. I mean, for 13 seconds, she went for that gold winning line and she was skiing for victory. And she took a huge amount of risk and it didn't pay off, but sometimes it would. And the other athlete I want to call out is Mia Brooks, because she went into that big air last run with the confidence in herself to risk it all, knowing that it might not be a landed trick. And actually, she'd never landed that jump ever in training, but she had the confidence to give it a go. And I think that, for me, is really inspirational to help people learn to get out their comfort zone, to push through their ceilings, to take those chances, to go big or go home. Because I think so many of us live within our comfort zone and we have these incredible Olympic role models who are going out there and maybe they're not winning gold medals, but they are going out there and pushing their limits. So hopefully we can take a little bit of that magic away with us. I thought it was an incredible Olympics, both from Team GB and both from the Italian organisers. And bring on Nice and the Alps.
We've got the Olympics coming up now. The next ones are in 2030. They're going to be in France. Effectively, that's your home country, because I think you were brought up in Tine and currently living in the La Rosière area out of season. I take it it's on your radar, a target for all three of you to attend?
Well, yeah, definitely a goal. I mean, we all had like a little bit of a goal in the back of our head for this Olympics, but like that was a big, big, big reach. So yeah, we're all planning on being at the 2030 Olympics.
And Freddie, you've been racing a GS this winter. Are we sensing that you're kind of specialising in that sport, or are you continuing to be skiing slalom as well?
Definitely not going to specialise in GS. I love slalom as well. Just the season, the beginning of the season, I started just more GS just because the opportunity to race the GS World Cups was there. Now I'm really focused on slalom. When I get back, I just want to train slalom non-stop.
So, Luca, how do you feel about, you know, currently we have three British skiers competing in the slalom in Italy next month. How do you think the prospects are of three Carrick Smiths racing in the slalom in France in another 4 years' time?
Yeah, it could be quite high if everyone keeps going and everyone's working harder, keep pushing until we make it.
No, well, you guys are extremely determined. You got really good support, and we're delighted to be able, at the podcast, to be able to help you on your journey as well. Thanks very much for your time today. That's great.
Yeah, we're super thankful. Thank you, Ian.
Yeah. Now, if you've been listening to those special episodes or following me on social media, you'll know while the Olympics were going on, I was on an epic trip by rail that took me from London to Paris on the night train to Nice, then via Lyon to the Three Valleys for a couple of days after that. All of that was done on a 4-day Interrail pass from Rail Europe. That cost €212. Reservations cost another €100. So the total cost was about €300. So first up, I want to say, if you want to do a multi-resort trip, I don't think you can get better value than that. And if you're also looking for value, when I skied in the Three Valleys, I stayed for the first time in Brie-les-Bains. Now, I think quite a lot of listeners will know it, but in case you don't, it's just 10 minutes from Moutiers. It's at 600 metres. It's low down, but it is connected by the Alamp gondola directly into Mirabel. And that means you can just get up in the morning, hop on the gondola and go straight into the heart of Mirabel. The last one down at the end of the day is at 5:30, which is plenty of time for me to get some après ski in at the Rond-Point and come back down. The catch is, it's 30 minutes each way. So it's an hour of your time spent in transit. But the upside is that Breed is much better value. And regular listeners might recall my kids are both doing ski seasons in the Three Valleys. And after I fractured my scapula, went out in January, I wasn't able to ski with them. So I wanted to do this. But it was right at the start of half term. And it is so expensive in Mirabel. It was way out of my price range. So, you know, I was able to find a decent hotel in Breed for about £130 a night compared with £500 a night in Mirabel. So for me, saving £400 a day was worth it for an hour of my time. Right. We are going to move on to somewhere completely different now, which is Georgia. Mike, I mentioned you last on the show when you told us about Pralu in episode 294. Actually, as you know, I've just been to Isola 2000 and I realized I was just on the other side of the Mercantour National Park, which you were talking about in Pralu. Such a beautiful and underrated part of France. But let's not talk about that one now. Let's move on to Georgia. This isn't your first trip there, is it? I think 7 years ago, back in episode 37, you joined Jim and I to talk about Gidari. This trip was very different. Can I ask where you were?
I was on the show 7 years ago, but that was from 10 years ago. And they kind of tied in because I was in Bachmaro in Georgia, a very isolated summer village that once the snow comes, the roads close and you can't get access to it in Western Georgia this time. In Bachmaro, the village is there, and they were celebrating their 10th anniversary of the powder project. Ingo Schlutis, he started the project in 2016.
I doubt many listeners are familiar with Georgia. I personally did look it up on the map. I wondered if we could just do a brief geography lesson as to where the country is, where you flew into, and how you got to Bachmaro from there.
So from the UK, there is no direct flight to the closer airport. So I went in via Tbilisi, and there's a number of operators, but I went with from Luton with EasyJet, one-shot deal, so you don't have to worry about your bags. But if you want to change or you can come from a different gateway, then either Batumi, which is on the Black Sea itself, or Kutaisi, which is a village, a smaller town actually, closer to the skiing. They are both great gateways and various operators fly into there. From Tbilisi, it's about a 5-hour drive. And then from Kutaisi and Batumi, it's about a 2-hour drive. And pretty much when you stand, you know, to jump forward and then we'll jump back, when you stand on top of the mountain, you can see the Black Sea from the top of the peaks, and you can see it stretching all the way around then to the Black Sea coast of Turkey. So you're in the former Soviet Union side on the Lesser Caucasus, right by the Black Sea.
So evidently you're getting away from the crowds. You mentioned the place you were staying is uninhabited in winter.
Now it's not. It was very much a therapeutic, very, very similar to the sort of wellness areas that were popping up in the Victorian period in the Alps, where people would go to get the mountain air. And historically, it's been a summer resort to treat people with respiratory ailments and tuberculosis, that type of thing. And the locals believe the combination of the air and the pine essence that comes from the trees, 21 days and you'll be cured. I'm not sure about that. I wasn't fortunate enough to spend 21 days there, and I wasn't there in summer, but certainly it'll calm your mood because you are definitely in the middle of nowhere.
You mentioned this is the 10th anniversary of the Powder Project, and I think that it's due to their involvement that Bakmaro has started to develop a winter population.
Yep, that's correct. Prior to that, it was just a summer destination only. The snow would come down in October, November, close the road, and everybody would be out of there, would be isolated. But the combination of his vision and the use of snow cats and snowmobiles meant that they could transport a lot of stuff up over the summer months and prepare ready to be isolated for that winter time. But then because of the nature now that people are coming in on a weekly basis, they can get a regular top-up of supplies and that kind of thing. But yeah, there's a lot of houses up there for the summer market, but in the winter time, it's very much contained to the cat skiing operations.
Did you say that the road is cut off in winter? How did you get access to the village in the first place?
So you get to a meeting point, and it depends on the time of the year that you come there, of how far the snow line has gone up the mountain road. We traveled around about 18 kilometers, I think. So you get to a point where the car can go no further. You take your luggage out of the car and you transfer it to the waiting snowcat. And then the snowcat then will take you on the road that they've ploughed on the way down to the lodging, anything from 18 to 30 kilometres, depending how good the winter's been.
Right. So you really are isolated. I mean, I think I like staying in refuges, and they're going to be doing a few of those, you know, shortly. But you're up in the mountains, cut off by road. What kind of altitude are you at when you're based up there?
So it's a kind of a little bit of a basin where you come up from the front side where the road finishes, and then you get to a ridge line, and then you drop down into this basin which holds most of the car, all of the accommodation, and that ranges from about 1900 sort of to 2050 meters, depending where the lodge is located in that basin. And then from there, then the snowcats start from outside of your lodge, and then depending on the number of tourists that are in the area at the time, the snow conditions, you can access slopes that are directly above the accommodation and just do laps there, or you can travel further afield into various other valleys and ridge lines.
It sounds amazing. So all the access, you weren't ski touring on this trip, all the access, it's a cat skiing trip. So you're hopping into the cat immediately outside your accommodation. Now, how you mentioned that was around 1900 meters. How high up might you be going?
So the cat accesses terrain up to about 2,750 meters, but there are higher peaks that you can ski to or two. But with our group, there was no need. We were able to get everything we needed straight from the door of the cat.
Right, and so that's a big vertical drop that you're talking about there. I've got two questions there. One, what were the snow conditions like? Now, I've seen a couple of your photos, so I kind of know the answer to this. So it looked pretty good. But what was the snow like? And like, how many rotations do you end up getting per day when you're doing it like that?
So they market themselves as an alternative to the Japan experience that's really popular at the moment. So the Black Sea is a very similar sort of environment and weather pattern that other places in the world get, where there's a large body of water. The water lifts, it hits the mountains, comes down as snow. They don't get as much snow as Japan, but they certainly get a good base of 3 to 4 to 5 meters of snow sitting on the ground, and maybe 9 to 10 meters worth of snow through the season. We caught it in a funky week where the first 2 days were sunny and cold, boot top powder everywhere, which when you're out of the trees, you kind of don't want too much snow. And that's what we've kind of seen this last week, couple of weeks in Europe, where if you get too much snow in one go, then you can't access the great terrain. So it was kind of perfect for that. And then the middle 2 days, it got very, very warm and characteristically warm for this part of February, baked a lot of the slopes facing into the sun. So that made it a little bit trickier. And we were just waiting for the next storm system to come in. And thankfully it did on the Thursday. And we had about 50 centimeters through the day. So that was a tree day. And they've got a number of fantastic areas that they've explored and marked. And the guides know it like the back of their hand. One area they call Japan trees because it's very much deciduous. Silver birch very much looks like you're skiing in that sort of Japan environment. But for me, the real treat was an area they called the Beach Club, which is old growth beech trees, which you don't normally ski amongst. You could drive a bus through them, but they still provided the cover to make sure that the snow was in great condition. Lovely rolling terrain right through to very steep drop-offs, 300 or 400 meters vertical of trees, which alluded to your second question. It's a lot quicker to do laps within the trees than it is to do it in the high alpine, because they're more protected. So we were doing, you know, anything depending on the cat. We had a great cat. We had two couples from Germany, a couple from Manchester, and then four guys, Geoff, James, Daniel, and Richard, who had gone to school together in Toronto. This was their return trip to Bach Maro with Powder Project, and their 26th overseas trip together, where they go annually to try and ski somewhere new, and Europe is very much on their hit list. So it all depends on the number of people in your cat, the quality of their ability and fitness, I guess. So we could do anything from 5 or 6 long laps in a day to 12 laps, depending on the visibility and however the guide felt. Ultimately, the guide's in charge. And if they feel they can sense of who's sort of slowing up or if everybody's finding their feet. And as a consequence, then, unlike the heli operations, which is very military and very much, if we don't get X amount of vertical per day, then everybody's going to be up in arms. This was very much a quality over quantity experience, where the guides would take you to the best snow for that day. And as a consequence, regardless of whether you did 6 laps or 12 laps, everybody came back satisfied and felt like they'd had a fantastic day.
Oh, and you're staying in a village that is, you know, cut off by snow. The accommodation is basic without being Spartan, right?
Well, there's different grades. So Powder Project, who are the founders of that area, there's a number of competitors have come in since, because it's fairly unregulated, unfortunately. They've got 3 properties. They started with the Pioneer's Lodge, then the Riders Lodge, and now they've got the Stars Lodge. And each one is a little bit of an increase in quality, space. The price points are slightly different between them. But these are very, very modern, comfortable lodges, really warm, fantastic food, restaurant quality food, which gives you a sense of all the Georgian cuisine. Primarily it's Western Georgian cuisine, but they try to give you a sense of all the things that are available across the country. So no two meals are the same. And it's very much family style. And that's what Ingo tried to establish, was he didn't want private groups come in. He wanted people of similar ability and a similar mindset who wanted to share experiences in the wild, so that you can sit down over dinner, have different conversations, and then have that same camaraderie then within the cat.
It sounds amazing. You mentioned the different price points. Say there's a listener out there who's interested, you know, prepare us. How much does this type of trip cost?
So from about €2,800 to sort of €3,500 for the week. And that includes everything except the flights and the transfer from whichever airport you come into to Kutaisi. After that, everything is taken care of, which sounds like a sticker price, a big sticker price. But when you look at most places you go to now, and by the time you add up your accommodation, your lift ticket, the guiding, the access to untracked snow, which is getting more and more difficult to find, it's actually not a huge price point and significantly cheaper than going heli skiing or cat skiing in other parts of the world.
Oh, interesting. And you mentioned the opportunity to experience the Georgian cuisine there, even distinguishing between Western Georgian and other Georgian. I know when you do these trips, you know, you like to get more out of it than just the skiing, the cultural experience as well. Did you have the opportunity to try that at all on this trip?
I did, thankfully, to Masho, who was with the Georgia National Tourism Organization. That's why I flew in via Tbilisi, because the first time I went with my partner, Neris, we had intended to see Tbilisi because it's closer to Gdauri, the resort that we had gone to. But the snow was so good, we stayed up there. So I kind of missed out on that and regretted it. So in conversations with her, when she invited me to come out to celebrate this 10th anniversary, I came in via Tbilisi. And then I had a guide, Guru, who met me at the airport, stayed in a hotel in the city, and then he gave me an evening and a day tour before we drove west to go to Bakhmaro. And I also got to see the other second city, then Kutaisi as well. And I would recommend that if you can, to extend your visit either on the front end or the back end to explore these cities, because they offer something very, very different from the other cities that you might have used as gateways for other ski holidays.
What I love about doing this podcast is, you know, this is the 306th episode, and I'm still discovering new places and finding out about places that I'd like to go to, whether it's somewhere like Kitzbühel, which is world famous and, you know, is a big omission from my skiing CV, or whether it's something more adventurous like going cat skiing in Georgia. It's just going to continue. I feel like I could do these podcasts forever and go skiing forever, because there's so many places I'd like to explore.
And that's one of the things that Ingo has sort of established by having this sort of family style dining and people sharing a cat together, is it's not just about the location you're in. It's you talk over, and then it's a little bit of I've been here and where have you been kind of conversations to start, just to get a feel for how the week is going to go on. But once everybody knows they're roughly of the same ability, and nobody's got to con their way onto the cat, then there's a great amount of sharing of information, so that somebody from Austria or from Germany that goes regularly to Austria will tell you about their small little secret spots that you've never heard of because it's close to their home, and vice versa. So that's one of the beautiful things of meeting these different people from different parts of the world when you're in this kind of environment, is it's all about conversation.
That is great, Mike. I hope, listener, you've enjoyed these different areas that we've covered today as well. And if you have, or even if you didn't like it, I would love to know. You can leave a comment on Spotify, Instagram, or Facebook. Our handle is at The Ski Podcast, or drop me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com. Or you can follow us on WhatsApp for exclusive material released ahead of the podcast. We have had some feedback since the last episode. Colin Tierney on Spotify said, the joy of having to work is being able to record the Olympics and fast forward through the bits that don't entertain me. He also enjoyed episode 303 when we were covering Sweden, says that sounds great. Richard Baker, also on Spotify, said, I think Zoe Atkin might have deserved the silver, referring to episode 305. I think everyone in Britain thought she deserved the silver, missed out by 0.5 when she did that last run, as Emily and I said, just was convinced that she pulled it off. But there you go. Thank you, Richard. There are now 306 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with, and unbelievably all 305 of those have been listened to in the last week alone. That normally means that someone is binging on our back catalogue. So if that's you, listener, I hope you're not bored of my voice yet. If you would like to get some insight on a particular destination, listen to an interview with an athlete, or find out about the latest kit, just go to theskipodcast.com, have a search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest in there. I can also tell you, in the last week, people have been listening to podcasts across the planet. The majority of our listeners are in the UK, just over 20% in the States, but everyone else is spread as far and wide as, for example, Turkey, Tunisia, and Puerto Rico. If you would like to help the podcast this week, I have just one request. If you don't already, I would really appreciate it if you subscribe to the podcast. Just press pause now, go to your podcatcher of choice, and click that button. I'll give you a second or two. Thanks so much. And Don't forget, you can save yourself some money on ski hire if you use the code SKIPODCAST when you book at InSportRent.com. Right, after publishing 13 episodes in 18 days during the Games, plus also because I'll be staying in a refuge in Saint-Foy this time next week, I will be back with episode 307 in 2 weeks' time. So until then, I would like to thank my guest today. Anna, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ian.
I hope that the sun comes out on your next day off to get out on the snow. And Mike, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure and a privilege. Can't wait to be on the next time. Thanks, Ian.
And I would like to thank Tyrol for sponsoring the podcast. And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.